Blog Talk Radio.
It's time for the Roots and Roots Show with your host, Greg Rashid, bringing you history and music from the Black American diaspora. Greg and his guests' goal is to root the show's information in your psyche, providing you the roots to expand knowledge within your community. Now here's your host, Greg Rashid.
Well, I want to say hello to everyone out there. I hope you can hear me. This is Greg Rashid, host of the Root and Roots Show, which I haven't done in quite a while. I've been doing another show, which is still part of the pantheon of the shows I do, and that show was the Black Senior in Thailand show. But I'm doing the Root and Roots Show again because I'm concentrating with this show on Black history, the whole African diaspora, just doing the whole history where we talk about everything like we're talking about today, Black baseball in the 19th century, but we get into music here. We get into civil rights movement, the Black Power movement, a little bit of everything, what's going on now, what was going on years ago. And I'm just happy. I am just so happy to have on this program as my first guest for this year. And I hope he can hear me. I hope everyone's hearing me out there. I'm honored to have James Brunson. Can you hear me, James?
Yes, sir. How are you?
I am fine. And James is, first of all, we are like brothers, although we've never, we're all brothers and sisters, but like blood brothers in a sense, but we've never met each other, only on phone and on Facebook. But, and I know we are souls from a different, from a past somewhere that we'll learn about somewhere in the future. But
without
I am just so honored to have, I'm so happy to have him on here because he has written a monumental book. This book is, you know, it's, the title is Black Baseball in the 19th Century, and it's not only about baseball, but it's about African-American life in the 19th century, prior to the Civil War, right after, especially during the Reconstruction era and up until the dawn of the 20th century, and it is a three-volume, amazing, award-winning book. It's won the Robert Peterson Recognition Award from the Society of American Baseball Research, and you've won so many other awards. And I'm just like honored to have some, you know, someone of your prestige on this program to take the time just to talk about your book and your background. So I'm just happy to have you on here, James.
Well, Brother Rashid, again, I want to say I'm 100% in agreement. We've known each other somewhere. We are indeed kindred spirits.
I know.
And I want to thank you for giving me an opportunity to be on your show. And I'm more than willing to share what little knowledge I have on Black baseball in the 19th century.
And the funny thing, James, is that, you know, talking to you and also reading the book prior to actually talking to you, you know, last year, reading your book, it's so fascinating to know that originally you weren't doing any documentation or doing a book on Black baseball in the 19th century. You were doing it on art. And just talk about how you arrived at ending up doing a book on Black baseball.
Well, let me just begin by saying that I am academically trained as a visual artist. I am a painter. My expertise is watercolor. I also do printmaking. I was academically trained as an art historian. But at the time that I began doing research for a series of paintings called the Renaissance series, I wanted to focus in on Black cultural life and portray it from the 19th century through about 1945. And as I was doing research, I discovered that there was little documentation on baseball or football, for that matter, in the research that I was doing on these paintings. And I took a trip to the university library at Northern Illinois University in DeKalb, Illinois, which is where I did my undergraduate and some of my graduate work. And I was looking through the microfilm at the Cleveland Gazette, which was a weekly Black newspaper that ran from 1883 to 1945. And the publisher,
and by the way, for you younger listeners that are listening in, Michael, you know, you don't know how lucky you got it. You can just Google stuff. It's
about
microfilm, microfiche, you know, microfilm, microfiche. A lot of these folks, James, don't know what, you know, they've never experienced it. They never had the eye strain of looking at old newspapers, documents on microfilm or microfiche.
That's right. That's right. Well, the thing about microfilm or microfiche, but microfilm in this instance, it's very similar to what you could imagine as is a tape, photographed images on tape rolled around a reel, and in this instance, it is a black newspaper. So someone took every page of every newspaper for the Cleveland Gazette, photographed it, put it on a film roll, and you would take it into a dark room. You would mount it onto a, I guess you would call it a roller, and you would run the tape through these plates of glass, and then that plate of glass would project the image onto a screen. So that's essentially how that works. But I would make an argument for anybody that's scholarly, you know, I don't care who that person is,
right,
you're going to eventually have to go back to microfilm or microfiche, because oftentimes when newspapers in particular are digitized, they run into a problem where they are degraded. And by degraded, I mean they don't capture the full image. And sometimes, depending
right
on the type of newspaper that you may be looking at or looking for, there are newspapers that are not there. And the only place to get them is to actually go back to microfilm. But at any rate, the primary issue that I want to focus in on here is when I was doing research, I came across an article about a black baseball player named Isaac Carter, who played for the St. Louis Black Stockings in 1883. But in 1884, he was killed, and purportedly he was killed for burglarizing the home of a wealthy white doctor in St. Louis. Now, you know, if we're interested in talking about that story, we could certainly do that, but that is what piqued my interest in black baseball and my desire to identify subject matter that could be painted.
And, you know, you don't have to cover that story because I want folks to get the book on McFarland Press. It's Black Baseball in the 19th Century. And, by the way, you can call in listeners, and I know a number of the folks that we know that are into black baseball, Negro League baseball, are listening in. You can call in at the number here is 563 999-3479. That's kind of hesitant because I haven't used this number in a while. So, but that's
well,
the number to call in.
When I eventually called in, I got put on hold. I didn't know what was going to happen, and I noted that that was the number that you had put out there for people to call in. So, are there multiple lines on the same number?
Oh yeah, there'll be they'll always show up on here. So the one number will bring in a lot of folks.
Okay.
For those of you listening,
and let me just
please call
say, Brother Rashid, is I want folks to know that should they call in, I am not a Negro Leagues baseball historian. My focus is from 1858 to 1900. That's my focus. The Negro Leagues did not exist in the period that I'm covering. So I can't tell you anything about Oscar Charleston. I can tell you something about some of the players of that era, but that's really not the focus
right
of this book.
And the reason I wanted you on this program, because we are, you know, this is the 100th anniversary of the founding of the Negro Leagues, and there's this assumption out there that if you don't really know your, you know, history and all that, you know, black, you know, African-Americans didn't play baseball up until that time. And your book just really shows, the three volumes show that, no, that's not true. You're talking about prior to the Civil War. that there were black clubs and teams.
Of course. And I guess the fascinating part about that for me is the people who are historians certainly know about black baseball being played prior to the Civil War, for example, and they do mention a smattering of these historians, and I'm talking about some of the great white historians that have written on baseball, you know, in the 1960s and the early 1970s,
right,
including Robert Peterson. But no one has chosen to dig too much deeper than that for a variety of reasons. And one of the reasons, other than saying that there's something nefarious going on, I would just simply say it's too much work. It's too much work, too much research required to dig out or ferret out the details about black baseball at this time.
And it's just amazing the work that you've done on this book, because you're talking about, what, almost 1,400 pages of just important history. Now, again, I emphasize, yes, it's about baseball in a sense, but it's about the whole, what was going on with African-Americans during that period. You know, people who are totally forgotten, you have brought back to life.
Exactly.
I mean, you have brought these folks back to life. Many of these folks are what considered back then, and I guess you and I would be considered that back then, race men.
Yes, exactly. We would certainly have been considered race men. And then depending on the environment in which we lived, we may have even been invisible. And by invisible, I mean that some author, some journalist, some person engaged in a literary pursuit would speak for us, and the understanding would be from the readers, and by readers I mean middle-class readers, even though there were other readers as well, but it would be the understanding of those readers is that this is how black people think because this author said these things about us. And nothing could be further from the truth.
Well, it's like the book, you know, unfortunately, when I was in high school, the first time I heard about Nat Turner was the book that was written about Nat Turner that was written by a white guy, you know, making it like it was Nat Turner that actually wrote the book.
Yes, exactly.
And he was interpreting Nat Turner's thoughts, and I was, you know, I'm a kid in high school. I don't know at first, and then I learned once I got in college that, my goodness, this is all false.
And again, let's just add another layer to that, Brother Rashid. The pictures that appeared in the 19th century and then in the 20th century that allegedly depict Nat Turner are totally wrong. They're totally wrong because even at the time, he was described as a light-complexioned man, almost white, with blue eyes. So the thing that's fascinating about that is he had to be demonized. And in terms of representation or somebody speaking for the invisible, they had to construct an image that the reader at the time, whether it be in the 19th century or in the 20th century, could recognize as Negro. So to depict this person looking something other than what they needed to have as representative of the time would have been confusing.
It definitely would. And that's, you know, and the pictures, I want to get back to the baseball aspect. What you found, and you put some of the pictures in the book, many of them, are these grotesque images of us as baseball players. And talk a little bit about that.
Well, one of the things that I talk about in the book is that baseball is an equivalent to art. And what I mean by that is, as you look at art, art is just not this kind of singular thing. Art is a bunch of little arts, from the different types of art that you may use, to art history, to fine art, to mass culture, and on and on and on. And the same thing applies to baseball. Baseball isn't the singular thing. Now, we may want to idealize it as such, but baseball is a series of little baseballs as well. And when we look at the history of black baseball, we have to contextualize it within a historical time frame, particularly in the 19th century. And one of the things that I discovered as I moved along, I was disturbed and fascinated by these minstrel-like figures of black baseball players in the 1880s, 1890s. And they would depict black men, or they would depict these figures with these big eyes, big lips, long hands, arms, big feet in these baseball uniforms. And I knew instinctively, because I knew a little bit about blackface minstrelsy, which appeared around 1828 as a professional endeavor for white men who painted their faces black and actually appropriated black cultural production, that being music and dance. So I understood what that was about, but it had more meaning to me because that wasn't the answer. That was the late side of it. As I moved back through history to the 1850s, I discovered that the United States at the time had two fears or desires, and one was the fear that they would be viewed from England, having broken away from them, as a Frankenstein, a monster who turned against its master, who created it. And the same thing.
And I was about to bring. I'm glad you're saying that, because I was about to bring that up. That Frankenstein. Talk more about that Frankenstein image, because I had never thought about that until I read your book.
Yes, and from a historical context, it's important because It gives us a greater understanding and appreciation for how black baseball players were described and portrayed in visual culture, whether it be as images, visual, or literary. And Frankenstein gained great prominence in the United States, the novel, in the 1850s. And by 1853, there were these narrations that were taking place in the country that referred to black people who were enslaved, this fear being that they would rebel and they would destroy their masters, similarly to the story of Frankenstein. Now, there was some context for this, and I'm sure you know this better than anybody. We could go all the way back to the late 1700s and early 1800s, easily 50, 60 years before this reference to Frankenstein, where black people revolted against their masters, burned plantations, and engaged in these revolts. So clearly they had some context for understanding this. But Frankenstein is significant because Frankenstein was not only created, he was constructed from several different body parts. And when you read about how black baseball players were represented in the 1850s, the 1860s, the 1870s, the 1880s, and the 1890s, it all goes back to this Frankenstein monster. When you look at the visual images, the heads are bigger than the rest of the bodies. The arms are longer than they need to be. The hands are humongous. The lips are big. The feet are huge. And all of these things take back to the construction of the Frankenstein monster, which is referred to as a mismatched body parts that were smelly pieces. And the other piece of this is, no pun intended, the reference to black baseball players as being smelly. So it all ties back into this. How the black body, in this instance, the black baseball body got constructed in baseball literature.
And that's something I never, you know, I've seen the images prior to your book, but never had that connection to the Frankenstein image. So I read your book, it was like the light bulb went off. It was like, of course. James is right, of course. That makes so much sense.
It's really stunning. And again, for your readers across the world, or listeners across the world, I want them to understand, this isn't about guilt, guilt on anybody. What this is about for me is, if we really believe in knowledge production, if we truly believe in trying to understand how black baseball players were treated, how they weren't allowed to participate in the major leagues or the professional leagues in the 1870s, 1880s, 1890s, this is where you have to go back to. And over and over and over again, you can pick a newspaper, you can pick a state. The major newspapers of certain states in those relatively large towns or cities, it is phenomenal that there are always these references to black baseball players being smelly or playing downwind from them or the smell that they created. It's fascinating. It's fascinating.
That's incredible. That is really incredible. It's something. And, you know, it's funny, as you're talking about minstrel, you know, images, blackface, it's ironic because next week on my show, I'm going to have Tim Brooks on, who wrote a book called The Black Minstrels of the 20th Century. And we're going
to
get into
that.
The music and, it's a fascinating subject. And you have more than touched on it in your book. Now, I want to know, you've told me, but I want to know for our listeners, you can call in and don't call me or go on Facebook or Twitter and say, oh, great, that was great. I wanted to ask James this. No, you got a chance to do it now. You got a chance to do it now. They always do this to me. But it's 563-999-3479. 563-999-3479. Talk to James Brunson, the author, amazing book, Black Baseball in the 19th Century, award-winning book. And, I mean, this brother here, that's the thing I want people to understand. How much time, years it took you to get this together?
Well, I say it took over 30 years in the book itself when I talk about what it took to get involved and move in this direction. And I started this project in 1985. Now, I had no thought on how large the book was. I had no idea about it would even be a book. I just didn't do it. But I became obsessed. And, my family, I have, at the time, I had two daughters. Well, I still have two daughters. And my wife, we would annually go to St. Louis, Missouri, to visit my relatives. And my youngest daughter, at the time we started doing it, she was three. And by 1987, my youngest daughter, she was born. And I always made time when I went to St. Louis to go to the main downtown public library in St. Louis to do research, because I became fascinated again with Isaac Carter. And that's when I discovered the St. Louis Black Stockings, and I discovered how powerful they were as a force in St. Louis. And 1983, most baseball historians who know something about black baseball point to 1983 as a significant year for the St. Louis Black Stockings. And it's significant because Henry Bridgewater, who became the manager and owner of the team, he took the Black Stockings on three tours that year. Now, this is professional baseball type stuff. And he claimed professional status for his team. They went on three tours, but during those tours, they went to Michigan. They played black and white teams. They went to Michigan. They went to Ohio. They went to Tennessee. They went to Kentucky. They went to Illinois. They went to Iowa. And they went to Upper Canada to play. They played almost 90 games in 1983.
And I know some people are listening now. And James, I know some people are listening now and say, well, that's easy to do. Yeah. If you're thinking about now, But look at the time.
Well, and again, you're absolutely right. The major league teams weren't doing 90 games, man, in 1883.
Right.
Go do some research for yourself, or somebody may ask that question. They weren't doing that many games. So the significance of the Black Stockings, as an example, when I was doing this research, is what tied me to digging deeper and deeper. And from the Black Stockings, I discovered black teams in Chicago who were their rivals. And as I branched out, the Black Stockings played other black teams in other states. It led me to those teams, which led me to those states, Kansas, for example, which led me to the Eagle baseball team in Kansas, which organized in 1870, and they stayed around until 1889. But prior to them, it was the Lawrence, Kansas Union Regulators, which was the same team. So, again, how this played out for me, Brother Rashid, is as I identified teams that were playing against each other, it expanded. So it just took more time. And I became fascinated by who these people were. They became human beings to me. They weren't just names on a page.
And I have to say, they have become human. If you read the books, you read the volumes, I mean, they become, you bring them to life. You bring these folks to life who would have been forgotten. And I'm curious, has any of the any family come to you and said, thank you for remembering my great-great-grandfather, something like that? Has anyone done that?
Yes, I received a, I use Ancestry.com to do research on some of these baseball players too.
Right.
And I received through Ancestry.com from a woman who lived in New Orleans. And she told me that she was related to Walter Lewis Cohen. And I'm like, wow. And she said, I read your article in Baseball Journal, which at that time was being published by John Thorne, who was the official historian for Major League Baseball. And she said that she wanted to know more information on him. And, of course, you know, I sent her everything that I had at the time. And for your listeners, if they're wondering, Walter Lewis Cohen is one of those unknown black baseball players that needs to be brought back to life. He was born in 1860 in New Orleans. His mother was a mulatto, by that being she was, one of her parents was black, the other was white. But
right.
His father was German and Jewish, hence his name, Cohen. And
Cohen,
his
yeah.
father owned a large-scale grocery store in New Orleans. And he had at least two other brothers that I know of that played baseball, James and I think his name is Maurice, but I could be wrong on that. But he had two other brothers, and he played with them, and they were older than him. But Walter Lewis Cohen was so good that he was the captain of the team. And he helped to organize this team called the Pickwick Baseball Club. And the Pickwick Baseball Club was so named because there was a white supremacist organization, wealthy white man club, and they had this huge mansion called the Pickwick House. And they worked as waiters in this house. And they formed a baseball team, and they became a powerhouse in 1876 right through to 1886 or 87 when the name of the team was changed from Pickwick to PBS Pinchback.
And tell folks who PBS Pinchback is, because there's some folks who
PBS
don't know.
PBS Pinchback, for those
they should
that
know.
Need to know, he, if nothing else, you need to know about him. He is the first black governor in the United States, and he was the governor of New Orleans. Now, when you see pictures of him, you might be shocked. If you go online and you do a Google search and you look at images, there he is with his straight wavy hair and or straight hair and light complexion, and really he looks like a white man. But the significance of him, and you can find information on him if you go to the library. There have been books that have been written.
Oh, God, there's so many books on him. Yeah.
Yeah, but the ones that I love are the oldest ones, the ones that were written like in the 40s and 50s. You know, this guy was a riverboat gambler. He was a barber. He was he loved to go to the horse races and gamble. And he loved baseball. And the thing that sticks out to me to this day, and folks will probably scream and yell about it, he is alleged to have discovered one of the great pitchers of the 1880s and 1890s in St. Louis. And he brought this gentleman back with him to New Orleans, and he started pitching there before he came north and pitched for the Chicago Unions in the 1890s. And he continued to pitch into the early 1900s when he moved to Minneapolis.
That's amazing. And that pitcher was?
Well, I'm going to have to look his name up because I'm drawing a blank on him right now.
Don't worry about it, James. Don't worry about that. No, but the thing, we've talked about this off air, and it's in your book, and also in you're in the new book too, The Negro Leagues Were Major Leagues, and you get into this. I want you to talk about the whole thing about, because you just touched on the wait staff at some of these hotels.
Yeah.
Being ball players, as well as barbers, because this is a whole forgotten thing. And
yeah,
artists, too. Artists,
yes. Now you got me tied up, man. I'm determined now. I'm gonna find this guy and I'm gonna tell you who he is right now. I got my book
sitting
right
here.
You can
call
in
here.
Huh?
Okay. The number here is 563-999-3479. 563-999-3479. I'm talking to James Brunson, author of the monumental book Black Baseball in the 19th Century. Is on McFarland Publishers, McFarland Press. And they're great folks, by the way.
They are. George Washington Hopkins is the guy.
Oh, yeah.
George Washington Hopkins. And anybody knows anything about baseball and knows about the Chicago Unions, he was with them for many, many years before he wound up in Minnesota playing at St. Paul. So the thing about baseball that I discovered for black people, the question was, if life was as difficult as it was for them, in order to play baseball, you have to have leisure time. You can't play baseball without leisure time. And by leisure time, I mean that the grueling work that most Americans did, particularly men, and it didn't matter whether you were black, white, Latino, or Asian, the grueling work that you did typically was 12 hours a day, 6 days a week. And if you got an opportunity to play baseball, it would have been on Sunday. And in many locales around the country, baseball was not allowed to be played on Sunday. So those individuals that got the opportunity to play baseball that were black got those opportunities either being enslaved where they played some form of baseball, or they worked in what I call the hotel waiter subculture. Now, when I finish up this comment quickly here, Greg, I'm going to have to switch phones and, you know, maybe we can...
Oh, go right here.
I'm going to switch phones right now and I'm going to call you back if that's okay.
That's fine. I will, in the meantime, I'll play a musical interlude as you do that.
Okay, and I'll call you right back.
All right, that sounds good. And we're talking with James Brunson, author of the book Black Baseball in the 19th Century. He's going to call right back here, but you can call in right now. You can definitely call in. Again, that number is 563-999-3479. And I was going to play some music, but now I'm going to talk. I'm going to wait for James to come back. But I want to You know, this program is all about discovering rare moments in Black history, discovering, be it music, be it sports, entertainment, politics, day-to-day living. That's what we try to do on this show, the Root and Roots Show, where we go to the root of a problem, and in some cases, of a story, root of the story, find out, bring the branches up, and then have the roots grow in you, grow in you, and you just pass that knowledge on to other folks, or you pass it on to, you know, you keep it to yourself. And we got James. And you are there, James, I believe.
Yes, sir.
All right, good. And I didn't go to music because it would have taken. I didn't want to play Lou Rawls yet. So
that's fine.
That's been a little too long.
I thought I had this planned out on the phone. And I
apologize
to your audience.
Let me quickly
talk about the hotel waiter subculture. We know, for example, that the earliest resort hotels, and by resort I mean summer places where wealthy white people went to relax and spa and engage in the things that they do, the fun people, the people with the money, went into New York and New Jersey. And the most fabulous places in the 1820s, note what I'm saying, the 1820s were in Saratoga Springs, New York. And Black waiters.
And I've been up there. It's fabulous up there. Even, you know,
I know it is. I know you can still smell and feel the money up there.
Oh, God.
The,
Saratoga Springs, that whole area. That's a show in itself. But anyway.
Well, maybe you need to do a show on that one. Well, a quick summary is Black men and women were hired to work at these resort hotels. And it is difficult to point out when exactly Black baseball was being played, but we do know that Black people were entertaining white folks already when we got to that period. So it would have been Black musicians. They would have been hosting certain types of events where white folks were being amused and entertained during the free time that they had. But what we do know for certain is certainly by the late 1850s, men had organized baseball teams and they were playing ball games and entertaining white guests at these resorts. And the occupations that Black folks had at the time were waiters or bellhops. Some of them were hostlers and barbers. Now, the two major occupations that I identify as attached to Black baseball and Black baseball teams are barbers and waiters. And I refer to them together or collectively as the hotel waiter subculture. And by subculture, I mean that these Black athletes who were not only skilled at baseball, many of them were skilled as musicians. They served a dual function at these resorts. And this is where I would argue earliest organized Black baseball teams came from. They came from Black barbers and Black waiters, and they were attached to these hotel resorts, not just in New York, but throughout the country. Throughout the country, it was almost as if it was a cottage industry of we have these resort hotels and we need to entertain our guests. And somebody discovered along the way is, hey, these Black people can entertain us and they can keep us abreast of one of the sports that we love the most, the national pastime, baseball. Let's go to see them play. And the fascinating thing about this for me, Brother Rashid, is that I would argue easily that the so-called winter training where Major League Baseball would begin to go south into Florida or Arkansas or one of these deep southern states where the weather could be kind of semi-tropical where they could play ball in the winter, that Black folks
introduced that. And I say it because as early as the 1870s, when black baseball teams where these waiters or barbers were working, when the season shut down in late September and they closed down these hotels in the north, people with money moved to the south in the winter because they didn't want to be in the cold. And those same waiters, those same barbers, found themselves down in Florida and Arkansas serving that job that they did, but also playing baseball and entertaining there.
That's amazing. You know, and right now we are in the midst of spring training, both in Arizona and in Florida.
Yes.
And it's a little known fact that the black baseball players back then probably initiated that. Now, about to close here, and I want to ask, go ahead, James.
No, I'm sorry. That's one of those things that's discussed in the book, the Negro League for the Major Leagues. I deal extensively with that culture, that moving back and forth between the North and the South, and that hotel waiter subculture.
Yeah, so, and by the way, Todd Patterson, who wrote the book, will be on at the end of the month. So
great,
we'll be talking
great.
More about that. You know, but I want to, you know, before we go, I want to ask you this whole thing, this whole myth about that baseball at that time, black baseball being like a comedy, a comedic, you know, that they weren't really serious.
Yes.
And before you do that, I think we have a caller. Let me see if we got someone online. Are you there, caller?
Yeah, how you today?
Are you there? How you doing there?
Yes, I'm here. Yeah, the
ball
players.
All right, you got a question for James?
The ball players back then was serious. And, you know, I grew up in the St. Louis area. And there on Compton and Market was the old Stars Field. I seen it when I was a kid. I think in 1960, Martin Luther King spoke there. And St. Louis had Cool Papa Bell. Papa Bell was there in St. Louis. Kurt Flood lived there off of Natural Bridge in Euclid. Mm. You had my grandson plays for LSU, the travel team.
Great.
And he's trained with Ozzie Smith from St. Louis. He's trained with Kurt Ford, who played during the Whitey Herzog era.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah, I remember him.
Right.
I guess you're still in the St. Louis area?
No, I'm down south and I'm here around him in Louisiana. But let me mention some more things.
Well, I would let you do that, but time is running out here, and I want to ask James one more thing. But I want you to call back and talk about this sometimes, because we're going to be doing other shows like this. And I'm going to have James back come back on. So thank you for calling in.
Yeah, if you ever get a chance, check that museum out in Kansas City on 18th Street, man. It is immaculate.
I've been there.
You got an indoor
field. I've been there.
Well, you know it. I've been there
myself several times.
Take care, buddy. All right.
Okay.
All right, James. And I was asking about the comedian. We're almost running in. I got to get you back on. I definitely have you back on again. But the whole comedic aspect that some people believe in of baseball of that era.
Yeah, well, this is the thing that's important for me. I'm currently working on a book. It's called The Blues People, Music Style in Black Baseball, 1865 to 1910. And what I want to do is to dispel the nonsense that we deal with. And it's quite amazing to me, Brother Rashid, the number of baseball historians when you talk to them. And I'm talking about these are well-meaning, nice people when I talk to them. And I'm astonished at the beliefs that they hold. And they can't sustain those beliefs when you talk to them. And my argument is, and there's some black folks that have written on this topic, too, that point out that the 19th century was disregarded because You know, it was burlesque, it was vaudeville, it was comedy. And I would argue for your audience that it is pure misrepresentation. And by misrepresentation, I mean that the American society at the time perceived black folks as either childish, funny, or excessive. And baseball, when black folks showed up, whatever they were doing, it was regarded in the same way. And as an example to leave us with, we look at Ulysses Franklin Grant, or Frank Grant, who was a star baseball player in the 1880s, 1890s. Frank Grant was, he's in the Hall of Fame, by the way. He was so good, even with playing with white teams at the time before he finally started playing with black teams, because he had been bounced out from playing with these white teams. He was so good that the reporters would say he scooped and gobbled up everything that came to him, so much that he got bored with the regular style of play. And they called him, or referred to him as being excessive and a showman when it came to defense. He would add more to a play that they thought was purely unnecessary. But the bottom line that they missed is he was making plays that the average person couldn't make. So it became a circus act, something that was funny, something that
And, you know, as I was reading in the, you know, reading about him prior to your book and reading about him, it's like I can imagine him being like Ozzie Smith.
Yes, exactly. And again, acrobatic. A lot of the black folk, you hit the nail on the head, man. Ozzie Smith, when he started coming out onto the field, he would do those double somersaults before he got to his spot. Black baseball players were doing that as early as 1870. They would come out
amazing.
Of the field and here's one better. A ball would be hit to some of these players, and for those that they need to read the book, a ball would be hit to some of these players. They would be in the outfield, Brother Rashid. They would time the play. They would do a somersault, not a tumble, a somersault, and then catch the ball. Now,
that's incredible.
Folks went out to see this man. They couldn't believe it. And it wasn't just happening in Chicago. It was happening around the country. These guys were good, man. But they saw baseball as entertainment. They saw it as show business.
Right. And I wish we could go. I got to have you back on, James. I will have you back on. But I want, if people want to get a hold of you, you have a website or anything, or they want to talk to you further?
Well, they can look for me on Facebook, and if they're serious, we can go from Facebook to email. But for now, let's just start with Facebook.
Right. That's right. And I want y'all to pick up the book, Black Baseball in the 19th Century. And the author is on here today, James Brunson. It's a monument. It's an amazing book. 3 volumes, 1,400 pages. It's, like I said, it's not just baseball. If you just look at it as a baseball book, fine, but it's more than that. It's one of the best. I have to say that I've said this to you before. I want to say this on air for the record. It's one of the best history books I've ever read. In my top five. I mean, really, I'm telling you, and I've been reading history books since I was like for over 60 some years. This is one of the best. It's needed. It's really needed. And I just want to thank you, James, for being on today. Now, we're gonna conclude today with James' favorite song. And I want you to introduce this. I want you to intro the song. I want you to be the DJ. I'm sitting back here for a minute.
Well, I'm a Lou Rawls fan. Yeah, I'm from Chicago. Lou Rawls is from Chicago. Lou Rawls attended Deuce Arbor High School on Chicago South Side, which is the same high school I attended. And he's one of those guys. I call him a blues guy. Some folks call him a jazz guy, but as far as I'm concerned, blues and jazz are inextricably mixed, if you know
That's right.
The history of the music. And He talks about Tobacco Road, which is specifically
a reference. We're going to do the live version.
Yes, but it's still good. He specifically talks about Chicago South Side, Bronzeville, which is the black community, 47th Street, which is what he roamed at the time, and I roamed those mean streets too. So it's a song that has a lot of meaning for me, and to this day, strong meaning.
Well, I'm going to play it right now. James, thank you so much. We'll be talking later. Just thank you so much for being on today. You take care, James.
You take care, and God bless.
God bless you. And we're going to conclude the show today with Lou Rawls live, Tobacco Road. And this is Greg Rashid again. Go in love and go in peace. Volunteer somewhere where you can, and we'll see you next time on the Root and Root Show. And I want to say hi again to everyone that's listening on KUHS. Denver.com, created by the great Henry Archer Nutter, heard every Sunday at 3 p.m. Mountain Time. So, but a lot of people listening live in the East Saturday evenings. So, going love, going peace. Lou Rawls.
As soon as I was big enough to get a job, he saved me some money and buy me a ticket. And catch the first thing smoking. I left. And I made a promise that if they could just keep the thought out of my mind, I'd keep my feet out the city limits. Because my part of Chicago, just as all cities have this particular residential area, in Detroit they call it Black Bottom. In Cleveland, they call it Euclid Avenue, 55th, 105th, Central Avenue. In Philadelphia, they call it South Street. In New York City, they call it Harlem. Drop down below the Cotton Curtain, in Atlanta, they call it Buttermilk Bottom. But then you come out west, where it's the best. In San Francisco, they called it the Fillmore District. In Los Angeles, they used to call it Watts. They changed the name, though. I speak about this place because I'm quite familiar with it. Everyone is in some sense or other. So it all boils down to the same thing, don't it? I'm speaking about this place because, you see, now, like in the wintertime when it's very, very cold, and it gets colder in Chicago than anywhere else on earth, because when it's around 10 above zero and it's about 12 inches of snow outside, and the hawk, I'm speaking of the almighty hawk, Mr. Wind, when he blows down the street around 35, 40 miles an hour, it's just like a giant razor blade blowing down the street. And all the clothes in the world can't help you. And when you lived in a place like I lived in, where everybody had a key to the front hall door, because it once was a flat, but then they cut it up into kitchenette apartments. And you leave that front hall door open and the hawk get in there, boy, you'd be called a bunch of dirty names before you can get in your room. I speak about this, as I said before, because I know. Cause I was born in a dump. My mama died and my daddy got drunk. He left me here to die or grow in the middle of Tobacco Road. I grew up in a rusty shack. All I own was hanging on my back. The Lord knows how I loathe this faithful Tobacco Road. But it's a home, yeah. back road.
Well, now you got Tommy Stewart on the piano again, folks.
Tuning in. See you next time. And remember, spread the knowledge, share the power.